Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Andy Kolb, and I have the pleasure to talk to you today about secondary acute myeloid leukemia in children. Thank you for joining today. I'm a pediatric oncologist. I work in Moores Children's Health in Wilmington, Delaware. I have nothing to disclose today. So our learning objectives today, we'll talk about some of the key differences between acute myeloid leukemia in children and adults. We'll talk about the toxicities associated with therapy. We'll talk about some of the safety and efficacy data that we know about treatment for AML and secondary AML, and outline some recommendations for secondary AML and treatment moving forward. So secondary AML is a very rare subset of AML in children, so a rare subset of a rare disease. And I think it's important because of the differences in pathogenesis of AML in children and adults, I think it's important to make sure we focus first on understanding what secondary AML means for kids. This is a review or a registry from Northern Europe looking at the incidence in adults of de novo AML, secondary AML, and then therapy-related AML. In the adult cancer world, secondary AML often refers to AML that's evolving from a myelodysplastic syndrome. In children, myelodysplasia is rare. Clonal hematopoiesis is rare. Most of the genetic events that cause leukemia in kids don't have a predisposing or a predecessor phase of myelodysplasia. Most of these events cause AML. So when we talk about secondary AML, we're really referring to therapy-related AML in children. This is AML that is the result of exposure to chemotherapy, exposure to toxins, rather than AML that has evolved from a myelodysplastic clone. In the European data, you can see that the yellow bars represent secondary AML, so AML evolving from myelodysplasia. And then the gray bars at the bottom are the therapy-related AMLs. And like adults, these therapy-related AMLs account for a very small subset of the total population of patients with AML. The other key difference between AML that we see in children and AML that we see in adults are the molecular pathways that are mutated, so the molecular pathogenesis of this. In the upper left, we can see the frequency of mutated pathways, and many of these are shared with adults, though not all of them. And then on the right, we can see the list of variants, commonly mutated variants, that occur in children, shown in blue, and adults, shown in red. And I think what's immediately apparent looking at the red and blue bars is that, you know, where you see blue, pediatric mutations, there's very little red. Where you see red, adult mutations, there's very little blue. So the mutation types that that we see in pediatric and adult cancers are very different, and this is very, very well illustrated by KRAS and NPM1. KRAS mutations are common in infants and children, rarely seen in AYAs or adolescent young adults and in adult patients. NPM1 mutations are rare in infants and young children, but more commonly seen in adolescent young adults as well as older adults. The exception, of course, to this is right in the middle, FLT3-ITD, FLT3 internal tandem duplication. These represent about 18 to 20% of both adult and childhood leukemias. So we talk about AML, we talk about secondary AML, we talk about treatment-related AML. I think it's important to bear in mind the key differences between the disease that we see in older adults and the disease that we see in children. And the fundamental difference is the molecular pathogenesis. It's also illustrated by fusion types. This is, again, data from Hamid Boulari's Nature Medicine paper in 2018. On the left-hand side of this figure, you can see a variety of different fusions that have been identified. So these are translocation events that have been identified in children, adolescent young adults, and older adults with AML. And again, what's apparent is that the fusions that we see in infants are not the same fusions that we see in adults. The fusions that we see in adults are not the same as what we see in children and infants. We also see a lot more fusion events in children and adults. And I think this goes back to, again, to the pathogenesis, that leukemogenic events in children tend to be these catastrophic mutations that can occur rather than an accumulation of smaller mutations, single nucleotide variants, for example, that are commonly present in adults with myelodysplasia and then adults with who transform to leukemia as well. And lastly, just to illustrate the point one more time, in this figure, we're looking at fusion events in blue, and we're looking at single nucleotide variants, so smaller insertions and deletions in green. And on the x-axis, we're looking at age. So fusion event frequency goes down with age, single nucleotide variant frequency goes up with age. Again, just illustrating the continuum of differences between children and older adults with AML. So moving into talking about secondary AML, and again, in children, we're talking primarily about therapy-related AML, so AML that occurs after exposure to chemotherapy and radiation in children with another cancer diagnosis. There was a review put out by a group at MD Anderson in 2009 that identified about 20 patients that had secondary AML, therapy-related AML, and described the demographics of these patients. Many of these patients had been exposed to chemotherapy for sarcomas, brain tumors, and acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So these are therapies that are heavy in alkylator and epipodophila toxins like etoposide. Many of these patients had mutations either in the KMT2A gene at 11q23 or had a monosomic event like monosomy 7. These are the more common large genetic events that we see in children with secondary AML. On the figure on the left, we can see that the incidence of secondary AML in this single institution study has increased over time. I think this is primarily due to two factors. One, children are receiving more and more intensive therapy over time. And two, more children are surviving their initial therapy. So sadly, secondary AML is a disease that we see only in survivors of their disease, of their initial disease. So these two factors conspire to lead to this increasing incidence with time. The other important point in this figure is that the overall survival in patients with secondary AML, children with secondary AML, is around 20%. And this is true for patients that have myelodysplasia, as well as patients that have a secondary AML, so secondary MDS or secondary AML. And most of these patients survive following chemotherapy with or without transplant. In a subsequent study published just this past year from the group at St. Jude, they looked at 84 children who had secondary AML. And if we focus on the pie graph in the middle for a moment, can see that the distribution of primary cancer types, 70% of these kids had a heme malignancy, while 30% of these kids had a solid tumor, either intracranial or extracranial solid tumor. Among the solid tumor patients, again, sarcomas account for more than half of the diagnoses in children with secondary AML. And then among the heme malignancies, primary heme malignancies, ALL is the more common primary malignancy in children with a secondary AML. The figure in the upper right shows the number of mutations, number of variants identified in patients, children that have either primary myelodysplasia, therapy-related myeloid neoplasm, including the MDS patients, as well as patients with de novo non-secondary AML. And you can see that the number of variants present in these patients is higher among the patients with a treatment-related or secondary AML. The variants of interest that have been described include commonly mutations in the RAS pathway, so KRAS, NRAS, PPTN11, NF1. These are all genes that are involved in RAS pathway activation, as well as WT1, RUNX1, and TP53. So these are coding variants. These are variants that are thought to be pathogenic and RAS pathway mutations are among the most common. This figure is a bit more complicated, so let me walk through from the top. The second row shows the secondary diagnosis. In yellow, we have patients with secondary AML, and in gray, we have patients with myelodysplasia. Majority of these patients have secondary AML. If you look down a few lines, you can see that the patients with a KMT2A rearrangement, most of these patients had AML rather than myelodysplasia. If you scroll down a couple more lines, you can see that MECOM expression is elevated in many patients, many pediatric patients, even in the absence of a mutation, but elevated in patients with secondary AML. A couple rows below the MECOM expression is the deletion 7 or monosomy 7 phenotype, and you can see that these are almost mutually exclusive with the KMT2A rearrangement. So together, KMT2A rearranged secondary AML and the monosomic phenotype, or monosomy 7, account for a majority of the children that are diagnosed with secondary AML. And I think this speaks a little bit to their exposures as well. KMT2A rearranged AML are more commonly seen after exposure to epipodophila toxins like etoposide, as well as drugs like anthracyclines, doxorubicin, daunorubicin. Whereas the monosomy 7, we see more commonly in patients that are exposed to high doses of alkylator therapies like cyclophosphamide, ifosfamide. And this may be a reason why we see such a high concentration or a high incidence of secondary AML in sarcoma patients who receive high doses of both etoposide as well as alkylator-based therapies. The rest of this graph is looking at the incidence of other variants, so commonly single nucleotide variants. And I think what's interesting here, we talked previously about how KRAS mutations are among the most common, and you can see that these seem to cluster more with patients with KMT2A rearrangements. So this is an outstanding review of the molecular events that lead to secondary AML in children, and I think a very comprehensive description of the mutational profile in these patients. So let's switch gears and talk about the treatment of AML. And in pediatric cancer, we often celebrate the success of therapies for children with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. 50 years ago, with the advent of multimodality therapy, with the introduction of CNS prophylaxis, the prophylaxis against CNS relapse, we saw a very rapid increase in survival through the 70s and 80s in children with AML. Over the last 20 years, we've seen more modest but still significant improvements in survival, and such that we have been able to focus a strategy around targeting intensity, so making sure kids with high-risk disease get more intensive therapy and kids with low-risk disease get some toxicity-sparing therapy or less intensive therapy. And we've also been able to introduce targeted therapies, including tyrosine kinase inhibitors, now immunotherapies, to the backbone of ALL therapy successfully while still improving survival. In some molecularly defined subsets of children with AML, survival close approaches 100%. And we contrast this to acute myeloid leukemia in children. This is all comers with acute myeloid leukemia, not just secondary AML. And part of the issue, part of the challenge is that we really only have a couple therapeutic modalities. We have cytarabine, high-dose ARC. We have anthracyclines like daunorubicin, idarubicin, mitoxantrone. And then we also have a transplant, or stem cell transplant. In the last 20 to 30 years, any improvements that we've seen in survival have really been credited to improvements in supportive care, improvements in the number of patients able to go to and survive a transplant, not to the introduction of new therapies. The exception is the recent approval of gemtuzumab ozogamicin, a CD33 targeted antibody drug conjugate. With gemtuzumab, we do see an improvement in event-free survival and a reduction in relapse risk. But I think what's most important here is to understand that we've really had a survival plateau for the last 30 years, despite maximally intensive therapy. So when we think about improving outcomes in kids with acute myeloid leukemia, we have to realize that we're already hitting our heads against the toxicity ceiling. There's not much more that we can give these kids without causing significant short and long-term side effects. And this is a view of the survival curves for sequential cooperative group studies conducted in North America. And clustered at the top is AAML-03P1, 0531, and 1031. This represents about 15 years of phase 3 studies, and survival curves are overlapping, highlighting the fact that we need better therapies. But we also have to remember that we are giving maximally intensive treatment, and this is what that looks like. So most children who don't go to transplant will receive about 440 milligrams per meter squared of anthracyclines. They'll receive many grams of cytarabine. And in our past phase 3 study, we transplanted about 25% of patients. In a current phase 3 study, we expect that we will transplant nearly half of patients in first complete remission, so half of patients following their diagnosis. And what does this mean for toxicity? A lot. So the cumulative incidence of left ventricular systolic dysfunction is about 20%. So one in five kids will experience some cardiac dysfunction during their treatment. Those who do have a significant risk for cardiac dysfunction long term. There's a 20% incidence of bacteremia during induction, and this is with antibiotic prophylaxis. So even with prophylactic antibiotic therapy, one in five kids will experience bacteremia during the first couple cycles of treatment. And then lastly, I think we all know the risk of long-term follow-up, long-term side effects goes up significantly with allogeneic bone marrow transplant. But there's also an interaction between these. High doses of cytarabine can lead to risk for bacteremia, which can lead to cardiac dysfunction. And among patients who have cardiac dysfunction, whether it's due to infection or anthracycline exposure, their overall survival is worse. So we're looking at event-free survival on the left, overall survival on the right. For patients that have experienced left ventricular systolic dysfunction, the red curve, and those who did not, the green curve. And you can see for both overall survival and event-free survival, cardiac dysfunction predicts a poor outcome in these patients. Unfortunately, we can't cure kids without high doses of anthracycline. We can't cure kids without high doses of cytarabine. Both of these increase risk for cardiac dysfunction. As far as the treatment specifically of therapy-related AML, there have been a couple studies that are informative. This is a study run by Todd Cooper and published in JCO last year. This is a phase 1, phase 2 study of CPX-351 or Vyxeos, followed by a cycle of fludarabine, cytarabine in patients with relapsed AML. The adverse events shown in table 2 were consistent with what we would see for any intensive reinduction therapy for a child with relapsed AML. About half of the kids get fever and neutropenia, half of the kids get some sort of infection. Overall, the therapy was quite tolerable in these patients. And it led to a significant response rate that you can see in the table, labeled table 5. We have an overall response rate in these patients of around 80%. That includes CR, CRP, and CRI. This is a study recently published by St. Jude looking at a handful of patients with secondary AML and one patient who had Cornelia de Lange syndrome who had myelodysplasia followed by AML, that ultra-rare event that I described previously. And of these patients, all of them received CPX-351 or Vyxeos, and you can see that there were complete responses in all patients ultimately leading them to transplant in all but one case. So CPX351 appears very effective in relapsed AML. It appears to be very effective in therapy-related AML. Cumulative effect of the adult data as well as the phase two data that I showed led to a label extension for use of this drug in children with secondary AML. And that concludes the talk. I appreciate everybody's attention today, and thank you for your time.